Okay, so the first kind of official, that now most of this stuff is these official ways of learning are taken from scientific literature. But as we spoke about before, you know, what science does is science studies reality. Science is not reality. Science studies reality. Science is always a query. There are no, you know, when people say, well, you know, there's scientific fact, they're probably wrong. Because, you know, at one point, scientific fact was that the Earth was flat. And the scientific fact was, you know, that women were hysterical or science, you know, whatever. Okay. Think of almost everything. And at one point, people believed it. And we see this all the time with, oh, my God, eggs are bad for you. It's scientifically been proven eggs are horrible. Oh, my God, scientifically proven eggs are fine. And, you know, in any given time, we have all these things, balls in the air. And the scientists themselves say, look, I'm just studying this stuff. I'm not, these are not solid, verifiable facts. So there is a huge contingent in the dog training world which believes that science is static, that learning is static, that there are certain ways of learning, like when we get into operant conditioning mostly, and that everybody has to follow these rules. And I'm sorry, but sentient beings or, you know, living beings don't follow rules nearly as much as we want them to. So whenever we're talking about these kinds of learning, you need to understand that there's a lot of variability, that when you get right down to it, learning's a mess. When my kid was going to school, it was they were teaching the latest scientific method of teaching reading was called whole word learning. And at that time, they weren't trying to teach phonetics. There were no phonetics. They were trying to teach the kids what the words meant, and they didn't sound them out. And what they did is create an entire generation of kids who couldn't read, because that's not how we learn how to read properly. Most of us at about the age of 7 learn to read. And it's an amazing thing. Our brain just says, time to learn to read, and that's what you do it. And almost any way you can teach it, kids will learn it. So one way of teaching will work for one kid, and another way of teaching will learn for another kid. But when those children are ready to learn to read, they will learn to read. When a dog is ready to do something, they will learn to do it. The problem is that a lot of times people, here's a really common one I get. My dog is like 10 weeks old, he's not house trained yet. Yeah, well, when he's ready to be house trained, he will be house trained. When his brain is ready for this to happen, it will happen. And so I think that all of the learning techniques that you use, you have to bear in mind that we still don't know. There's an awful lot that we don't know. That it really, when I say that learning's a mess, it's a mess. But that doesn't mean it can't be done. It's just that there's a lot of variables in it. So social learning, allomimetic learning, is learning through observation and imitation. So the dog does something after watching somebody else do it, like hunting. And up until, here's a good example, up until 20 years ago, it was not thought that dogs could learn by watching in the scientific world. Every human who owns a dog knows that they can do it, right? But the scientific world said that's not proven, therefore it doesn't exist until it's proven. Well, now they say, oh yes, well they can do that. But I remember teaching, when we were teaching classes, we were before agility, we taught jumps, right? So we would have the owner, you know, we put up on the jumps, and then we'd have the owner stand here, put the dog on a stay, and the owner would walk like this over each jump. And then they'd go to the end and they'd call the dogs and the dog would come over the jump. What is that if not observational learning? Because what would happen is if you told the dog to stay and you walked around the jumps and you called the dog would go around the jumps. And so it was, the dog was learning by doing it. I'm going to show you this in a little bit. It's a lot of fun. But so social learning is observational learning. It's also facilitation. You know, learning because others are doing it, even though they may not, you know, may not be watching. You're learning because. So with facilitation, the dog does something because everybody else is doing it. And a really good example of that is pack behavior. You know, in a dog park where all of a sudden a bunch of dogs will gang up on another dog, like the video I just showed, or dog walkers have to worry about this a lot, especially dog walkers who walk dogs off leash, because one dog will start to chase something and all of a sudden you've got six dogs chasing something. Mm-hmm. And it is pack behavior. It's natural behavior. And the dogs learn that this is a cool thing to do. And I know I have this someplace, but this is the problem that I have with Aspen and Heather. Aspen discovered that chasing buzzards is the coolest thing in the world because the buzzards come down and tease them, you know. And so they're coming down like this and Aspen's barking like crazy. I was going to try to get some video for this because you just see it. But she was the only one who did it. And now Heather started doing it. So now we have two dogs going, where are the buzzards? And now Flocka. The little, she's like, I'm going to do this too. So now I have to be on the lookout for buzzards because I know what's going to happen. And every once in a while I go, oh, give them some exercise. But I know that's not a good thing, you know. So, but that's facilitated behavior. Aspen taught herself and the other two learned from Aspen and learned by observation, learned by facilitation. And lots and lots and lots of dogs do this stuff and they will do things like pack up and kill something like a cat when they would ordinarily not ever do anything like that. So this is the video of social facilitation. You can really watch. These three dogs live together. The video, I'm sure these dogs are long since passed, but the video was given to me by somebody who wanted some help in working with it. It feels like it's kind of, she should have stopped, but she was doing this for me, just to let you know, okay?
Wait, let it go. Lucy, swim. Lucy, swim. Get her off. Come on, Lucy, out. Let him go. Let him go. Cabela. Cabela.
Cabela.
What is all this about?
Stop it. Now can we change it?
Yes.
Okay, so you can see that this is definite social facilitation. All three dogs are really great dogs. They all like each other. There's no problem with the dogs in the house. They don't hate each other or anything like that. But when they go into arousal, which is usually what I use this video for, is arousal, because this is an awful lot of arousal. But the social facilitation occurs, okay? Just to let you know, what they decided to do was rehome one of the chocolates. And that solved the problem completely. So the chocolates were siblings, and of course siblings are going to use social facilitation probably more than any other types of dogs. I was supposed to this week go see a woman in Petaluma who has 2 8-month-old Great Pyrenees, sister and brother, and they run the fence line back up and back, and you know, they're in Sonoma. They've got a, you know, huge fence line. They chase everything that goes by, whether it's a car or a bicycle or a jogger or anything else. And they are egging each other on and they're starting to attack each other. So we're getting high arousal with social facilitation, and then you get aggression that comes on the end of that. So I called her and said, I can't do it. I can't even hold my own big dog right now with my shoulders, so I'm not going to be able to hold one of your dogs. And actually, I'm kind of sorry I couldn't go, because I think what she needs to do is probably rehome one of these dogs, because she lives alone with two dogs. And how much do these guys weigh? Something like 160 pounds at full growth. So this is probably way too much dog for her. I actually suggested on the phone that she look into a hot wire. about that far in from the fence, and to put the what's that called, the yard, you know, the green stuff over the fence, because she's got, it's a cyclone fence, to cut off some of the visual, and then to use a hot wire to keep the dogs away from the fence, because she's terrified that they're going to break through the fence and go after something, and they will, you know, and they'll kill it, whatever it might be.
Would getting rid of one of them, do you think that would solve the problem?
That would probably really help the problem, because you won't have social facilitation. Then she's going to have to do some other stuff, like build an interior fence.
So if the other dog continues, and it probably will.
Yeah. And yeah, because now it's learned it. This is fun. This is a natural behavior, so, you know, I'm going to keep on doing this. So if you praise or otherwise reinforce social learning, it becomes stronger. Now, I was going to talk about the buzzards here, but I already talked about them. But if you tell a dog he's doing something that is good, then obviously it's going to get much better. But if the dog is reinforced by the behavior itself, it will get better and better and better. So Aspen and the, this is where we walk every morning. So you can see that the buzzards have quite a nice way to do this. So with the reinforcement in this case doesn't come from me, does it? It comes from the buzzards. And so the only thing I'm left with doing is putting the dogs on leash or yelling and screaming totally without any kind of effect on the dogs at all, which then teaches the dogs that I have no effect when I'm yelling and screaming. So I'm not terribly sure I want them to learn that.
Well, are they also being reinforced by each other as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. The social facilitation will reinforce each other. This is their bonding thing. Look at them there. They're just going, ta, here I am, you know. So you will get social facilitation almost any place that you see a bunch of dogs getting together. And this is a dog park. You'll see a lot of social facilitation. In fact, you'll probably see it at a football game or at a basketball game or any place where one person starts to do something and everybody else starts to join along with it. So we have to be very careful of that, because it actually impedes with the kind of learning that we want our dogs to have. But they will do it regardless of whether we want them to or not. So it's really important, especially for people who are dog walkers or who are daycares, to be cognizant of what the dogs are learning when you're not intending to be teaching them. Okay, so here, this is a fun way to use facilitated learning or observational learning to teach your dog. This is called Do As I Do. Anybody heard of this? No? Okay, this is very cool. Once you see this, you're probably going to want to look it up on YouTube. It's really neat. It is actually teaching a dog to watch what you do. They have to have a modicum of obedience first, and then you teach them to watch what you do, and then you teach them to imitate what you do. And I tried, when we lived in Santa Cruz and I had more time, I was doing it with Aspen, but I never videoed it. And I taught her to walk around a tree, jump up on different things, you know, it's just by watching me do it. And she did it, and they can, and so much for you, science. Because this is real. And so this is just a video of somebody whose dog does quite well with this.
Is that similar to shaping? I mean, when they...
No, it's not at all like shaping. Okay. It is not shaping. Shaping is doing something incrementally. Okay. This is a behavior that it's like actually what I was just talking about with going over the jumps. Yeah. You know, the dog is looking at the jumps, then going over the jumps because they're watching what you do. Mm-hmm. So shaping is much harder. Shaping is, and we'll talk about a lot about the shaping, is very frustrating for dogs. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful when you use it. still say do. Anybody have time to train a dog a little bit this week? I know it's hard, because just having that time can be hard.
Yeah.
But what I'd like you to do is to use this, okay? And I'm going to give you the beginning. You can actually look it up. She has a DVD. I think you can get it through Tozer Dog Videos. She is not English, so it is in subtitles. It is a little bit hard to follow. But do it anyway, because it's very good. The things your dog needs to learn to begin is like a sit, stay, and watch. Okay? So I'm going to do a little bit of it with Aspen. She's not going to do it because I haven't worked on it for well over a year. And as we've already discussed, you have to continuously reinforce things that you really want to have the dog to do. So Aspidistra, Aspen, come here. You get to work. What? It's right here. So, I should probably aim this stupid television or the camera. Yeah, you want to just... She's going, okay, what do you want me to do? Let's see what we can do a little bit of. Okay. Yeah, I know, good spin. Yeah, I know. You can do a heel. Yeah, you're good. Yeah, you are. You're very good. Okay, so it's a sit, and then sit, Aspen. Stop talking back. Wait. Watch. Let me see. What did I do before? Oh, I'll go back. Come on over here. Sit. Wait. Watch. This is too high. Do it. Very good. Okay. So just something really simple like that. It doesn't have to be, but you do have to get that wait and watch, because if you don't get, if you're not watching, then they're not going to see what you're doing. So, all right, y'all clear on how to do that? So you can see how easy it is. It also is not, it's an exercise in learning. And one of the precepts of learning that is really true, I'm done. One of the precepts that's totally true about this is that when a dog starts to learn, to learn, they start to love to learn. And when they love to learn, they start to learn much more. So just getting a dog started in something like this is really a cool thing. Y'all think you can be able to do that?
Yeah.
If you can do it and video it, even if you feel like a dope, I mean, I was just dopey there. I didn't know she was going to do anything. Just send me the video, and then we'll play some videos if there's some videos that are good. Yes, it's going. Thank you.
Does it seem like just something that they would train for assistance dogs?
Can you talk a little louder?
Oh, sorry. Is it something that they may use this system for assistance dogs?
They could. I think the closest they get to it, as far as I know, and there may be people doing it that I just don't know they're doing it, but they're, for hearing dogs, the dogs that answer doorbells and stuff like that, they do tend to use some of this with that.
Right.
They do mostly operant conditioning, so they mostly have a treat that is, you know, comes from the bell or whatever, but they're starting to incorporate it. And the method itself is being studied now by all the scientists who didn't think it could actually happen. So remember, this is something that up till 15 years ago or less, people are like, well, no, this kind of learning doesn't exist. But of course it does. And we see it all the time. So, okay. Aspen, I am so proud of you. Yes, I am. Okay, so that's facilitated lunch. I was just going, are we doing it again? Oh boy, we're going to do this again now. No, that was good. That was good. Okay, so non-associative learning is a big deal. Oh, by the way, if you also can think of anybody can think of anything right offhand of a dog that is, if you've had a dog that has learned through observation. Anybody think of it? Yeah.
I have a 12-week-old Leo at home, and he is learning from his big brother. Like simple things like potty training, it's blowing my mind how much easier he has been to potty train. And it's just because he watches Jack, our 8-year-old lab.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, okay, we're going to go outside and go potty. And Dakota, the Lamberger, just follows him out there and is like, oh, okay, this is what we do every morning. And it's just, it's been fascinating.
That's really good. Yeah.
It's
always nice to have the big brother around.
Yeah. That and the other big thing that I've really noticed that I really love is I definitely instilled in Jack the breaks with the play. Like when he was growing up, let him play for, you know, a minute because he would just get to a 10 so quickly and then break for 10 seconds and then go back. And because Jax knows that, you know, okay, oh, I'm at my minute, it's time to take a breather, Dakota has started naturally taking that break too.
So you're teaching good body language that way. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Do you have one of Cindy's Leos?
I do.
Ah, which one was it?
I have Orange Collar.
Orange Collar.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
I'd have to look at my list about
yeah,
what.
All, please tell me, because they all had different colored collars.
Yeah, so. Right. And I was going through each one, going,
yeah.
Nice dog.
Yeah.
Nice dog. Yeah, so
yeah, it's been
that's great.
Because there's another littermate in Fairfax also who doesn't have a playmate at home. So when we get them together, that's when I really picked up on the things that Dakota is learning from Jack, because she doesn't know those things.
Mm-hmm.
So like the natural breaks or, you know, going outside to go potty, those things she just hasn't picked up on.
Right, because of course it's much easier for a dog to learn from a conspecific, from another dog, than it is to learn from us, because we don't go outside to go potty.
Right.
So yeah, it's much, much easier for them.
Yeah.
Okay, anybody else have anything that their dog, if you think of anything, bring it with you next week. You know, just let me know, because it's always interesting. And once you start thinking about it, you'll probably notice that your dog has actually done that. So it's non-associative learning or single event learning is when an event occurs in isolation, which causes the dog to be to think it's important. So your dog gets bitten by a bee. This has happened to me twice now with my dogs, and now on a trail, and now they're afraid of the trail. With Luke, he got bitten by a bee, and he actually, I think I talked to that anyway, but he got bitten by a bee, and then he refused to go on that trail In fact, it got worse and worse and worse with time. And then I had my Belgian Tervuren got bitten by a bee on a trail and just was, you know, she, because she, you know, they have so much coat. The bee was somewhere in her coat. And I ended up having to do this to pull the bee out of the coat. And that part of the trail always terrified her after that. And she would go to that part of the trail and go, you know, expecting that there would be something in her coat. So that sudden, that is non-associative learning or sudden event learning or single event learning. That is probably one of the biggest reasons why some dogs who are not aggressive but who are somewhat fearful turn aggressive, because of a single event learning and an incident of some kind. So anybody have any of that in your background? Yeah. By the way, this is Kyle.
Yeah,
guys.
Sorry. I worked at a daycare, and a dog, one of my dogs, got his foot caught in a chair. And before that, he was completely okay. You know, he was about a year and a half, completely okay in the playgroup. But when that happened, all the dogs rushed him. And after that, he kind of learned that behavior of, I guess, that pack mentality of watching all the other dogs go after him. So when another dog yelped or whatever, and all the dogs
he
rushed,
would do it. Oh my goodness, that's
I have to keep that dog separate because he triggers to my other dog barking and that kind of thing. So
that's interesting, because that's almost a double layer of it, isn't it? Because there was the single event,
yeah,
plus the facilitated behavior,
yeah,
and so you have, wow, that's a really complex behavior. Yeah.
I ruined a chihuahua's life. I was carrying my friend Ellen's chihuahua. We were at Isabel Dock Park and meeting with some other people, and our mutual friend Terry showed up with a brand new foster dog. A Boston Terrier, and I don't know what I was thinking, but I was holding Pine, and I said, do you want to say hi to Barnaby? And Barnaby lunged and grabbed them by the cheek, and just, that was it. Pine has been reactive ever since, cannot be left off leash. He has this, I will get you before you can get me. It was like cutting cutting it with the knife. That
right.
Moment changed his entire life.
Yeah, yeah.
It never.
And you feel awful about it. And there's nothing you can do. You can't go back in time. You can't fix it.
I mean, I don't know what I was thinking.
And the thing is that so often with single event learning, people don't even realize that their dog has done this. You know, they get rolled in a dog park or something, and that colors their behavior towards other dogs for the rest of their life. But the owners looking at this don't even think this is a big deal, because to them it looks like play. But because, remember, the big part of non-associative learning that is so important is that it involves surprise. And no one, not humans, not dogs, likes surprise. We may pretend we like surprise, but we want to have an inkling that something's going to happen. If you're going to throw me a surprise birthday party, let me know.
Had our very fearful dog Buster, I think he just had all these series. Everything for him was single event. Like one thing happened, that was it. And he played the Kong Wobbler one day for a couple of minutes, and I think we didn't see it, we just heard him yelp, and I think it bounced back and bumped him. That was it. He would never go near the Kong Wobbler again. Or one time his tags got caught in the frame of his water and food bowl, and he went to lift his head, and he couldn't, and then he would never go near that frame. Of course, we got rid of it, but he would never go near that again. It didn't matter. And the Kong Wobbler was, you know, didn't hurt him, but it hurt him mentally.
And the more mentally sensitive a dog is, the more likely they are to respond to single event learning. I had a Malamute back when my young dumb age years, and I was pretty dumb. I actually tied him up at a 7-Eleven on a newspaper rack, and a car came and parked. You know, he was like right here, and a car came parked right here, and terrified him, and he took the rack and left. I mean, this is a Malamute, right?
Yeah.
So he just ran, and he took the rack came after him because he was on the leash. Well, he didn't want to go out in civilization after that at all. He didn't want to go any place where there were cars or any kind of clanky noises or anything. And I was just pretty dumb, you know.
And you can't fix that.
No, I mean, you can try doing desensitization and counter conditioning with it, but it is But if you don't keep up the process, then the dog will tend to revert. Remember that these kinds of memories, traumatic memories like this, stay in the amygdala. And apparently they stay in their entirety. So if somebody has PTSD, when that trigger happens, they remember the event. So most of our memories are like this, right? Maybe you're like, oh, God, I remember that person. I remember meeting her. Where did I meet her? Oh, what was her name? And you're taking all these pieces of information, you're putting them all together like a puzzle until you finally go, oh, I know, it was at a this and a that, right? So that's how come, that's what we do with memory. But when it's a traumatic event memory, then what happens is that memory is held completely intact. So if you remember, if you had any kind of thing like when you were a kid, if you can think that, I remember when I was 3 walking on grass when we lived in Ohio and I got stung by a bee on my toe. And I remember the feel of the grass on my toe. That memory is so strong. And we assume that, particularly since dogs think in pictures, that their memory is probably even stronger and they can't rationalize their way around it. They can't go, you know, we spent most of our days rationalizing this, rationalizing that, but they can't go, okay, the rest of the grass is fine. The other thing about single event learning that's very important is that if a dog is over the age of 3 and they have a single event learning episode, then they are much less likely to have it have a huge impact. If they are under the age of 3, if they're under the age of a year, it's gonna be really hard to get rid of that. So that's why we say with your puppies, you're really trying to actually keep the puppy safe until they are old enough to be able to go, oh, I guess I'm all right. Now, having said that, there are some dogs that are just naturally pretty darn resilient. And, you know, everything's going to be fine. I can cope with this, no problem at all. Whereas others are going to be it's going to be very difficult for them to cope.
So if you have a dog that has a singular who's maybe not quite as resilient and they have these single event learning events, and will they generalize to other things?
Oh, God. Well, I'm going to talk about that. will they do that? Yeah. So just to go on with that, a non-associative learner, it's a dog that has learned through this, will see coincidence as correlation. It's a big problem with people, too. We see coincidence as correlation when it is not a correlation. So a predator sees a prey on a trail and searches that spot every single day thereafter. I mean, I saw a coyote on a trail walk one day. Actually, I've seen several, and I always look at those spots every single, like the coyote's not moving. You know, no, the coyotes move. Yeah, so that's a non-associative learner. So this is part of the trail I walk on. And see, it says skunk in there somewhere? That's because Heather went after a skunk and got skunked last year when it was so rainy, right in that little copse of trees. And she, for her, it was a lovely single event learning. For me, not so much. So she, you know, so still, I have to leash her going past that spot because she's dead sure that squirrel is that skunk is still in there, and she's absolutely sure that she wants to go get it. So, you know, they have really, really strong memories of that. It was a coincidence, the fact that the skunk was in there. I don't think that's actually a skunk nest. Could be, I suppose. But it's not a correlation, but the dog is going to see it as such. And again, I'm trying to think of what with people do the same thing all the time. We think, oh my God, I was just thinking of you. That's a coincidence. It's not a correlation. And we still, many, many people have magic thinking. And that's one of the ways that magic thinking manifests. I actually even have a magic wand that hasn't worked yet. Yes?
Okay, with your skunk incident, now it's probably a dumb question, but I had a dog that got skunked, and every time she smelled one, she would take out the door practically to get out to get it. And I thought, well, wouldn't you learn?
No.
I mean, and I know that's stupid, but it's...
No. To you, the skunk smell is really awful. But it's not apparently that awful to dogs. If they get all the way up in it and they get that acid, because it's really bad.
Yeah,
and
you get it in the face.
Yeah. then if she's pretty predatory, that's still not going to, that's not going to override it. Some dogs do learn from that, and you would think they do. I remember with one of my Cairn Terriers, Gordy, I was walking in San Francisco, and we lived in a place where we had skunks living under our house. It was lovely. The smell would come wafting up through the closet, so all of our clothes smelled like skunk all the time, especially in February when they mate. Oh, my God. So my roommate and I were brilliant in the way we got rid of them.
My business partner's Minpin got bitten in the face in my backyard by a rattlesnake. And it was a terrible experience and had to spend several days in the hospital. You would think she learned her lesson. When she got back into my backyard, she went right back to the spot. She's like, okay, where's that thing?
Yeah,
I'm going to get it. There's a rematch.
Well, here's the other thing that probably happened with that and could have happened with a skunk. When they get into a certain level of arousal, they stop thinking. So they've gone into kind of their reflexive brain, and so they may not even identify what it is they're looking at. So when you do rattlesnake training, for instance, they use an e-collar for rattlesnake training. So the dog looks at the rattlesnake, and immediately they shock it. So then the dog is still in its thinking brain when they shock the dog for looking at the snake. They want the dog to be terrified of the snake. Yeah.
So when you do, so it seems so weird then that they would use the e-collar for dogs that are fearful of other dogs. So they see a dog, they shock them, and then the dog.
I didn't say the trainers are smart, but.
I know, but it seems so. Then they would be like, this is how you train for a rattlesnake, but then it's the same, and so why wouldn't the dog also?
Well, because if you're using an e-collar appropriately, you don't use it like
you
that.
You don't, but yeah.
I know a lot of people do, but a lot of people think you punish it because that goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning. They think the dog knows the difference between right and wrong. If you think the dog knows it's wrong to be aggressive against another dog, then you're going to punish it for doing that. But if you take that right and wrong and erase it from your brain and go, okay, the dog does what works or doesn't work, that's it for the dog, then you wouldn't do the punishment. But if you're thinking right and wrong, you will do the punishment. So, but the skunk thing, Gordy, my Cairn Terrier, I got a fear of the skunks after he'd been skunked like once or twice. And so one day we were walking up the street and I saw a skunk and I yelled, "Gordy skunk," at the top of my lungs, and he turned around and ran. And I'm like, whew. But I know what he was running. It was because I was so scared. I did not want him to get skunked. I did not want to have to, you know, drag him behind the car. No, I wouldn't. But, you know, yeah.
So if you have a dog, like I have a client whose dog does it in the backyard, he's chased two skunks and killed one skunk. And then he saw a raccoon, and so every time he goes in the backyard, his arousal is huge. So we work on very calmly taking him out back on the leash and not let the wife actually can't because she's way nervous about all of it.
Uh-huh.
How do you, can you?
You have now inadvertently fulfilled the promise of the predator.
I know. It's he's so.
Once they've learned to kill something, they go, oh, that's what these teeth are for.
He's so excited.
I didn't know.
He's so excited.
Yeah.
Is it forever they want to take him on the leash out in the backyard if they want him to be in the backyard?
Okay, so this is a good learning thing. So what does the dog have to learn?
To stay calm when they go out in the backyard.
Right. That's what the dog has to learn. So I would probably, is it a big backyard?
It's like a nice size. It's not crazy big. It's like a normal suburban.
And the dog goes crazy every time he goes out.
He runs out, and he actually is like chewing up their fence because he saw a raccoon apparently on the fence. And then he will run out in the yard and just go look for the, you know, he's obviously looking for probably a skunk. And he's just highly, highly aroused. But he is very food motivated, so he can.
Well, the problem is he's food motivated, but he's motivated more by prey.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're thinking about reinforcement, you always have to figure out what is the most reinforcing thing for the dog.
Yeah.
And in this case, going after the prey would be. I probably would take him out at least twice a day and do obedience.
Okay.
Really a lot of obedience around the perimeter of the yard.
Okay.
I would make dead sure that you might even consider, I don't know what you could use, but some kind of spray to change the scent of the yard for a while. You know, I'm not sure what you could use. Anybody have any ideas?
Yeah, I can drink, it really smelled terrible, but that liquid fence, you know, which keep deer off plants, it's rotten eggs and garlic, and it doesn't hurt anything. You know,
Smells like a lot of rotten eggs, so that'd be great. It's called what?
Liquid fence.
Liquid fence. Yeah, try that. I had a situation with I was doing a cat call, and I had the cat had been in, this is talk about great non-associative learning, but anyway, the cat was in a room, and on the outside of the room, a raccoon went by, and so there was a smell of raccoon, and the husband in the family, no, it was the wife, went outside, probably just to do something. I don't think she was trying to get rid of the raccoon or anything. But when she came back inside, the cat attacked her. And the cat had always gotten along fine with her. And after a lot of discussion, we decided that the cat thought she was the raccoon. That she had probably put the scent of raccoon on her, you know, because he had been there and raccoons do mark. And so if he had marked on a plant or something, then, and she picked up that plant, she would then smell like the raccoon, and that triggered the attack. Not a big deal if it was only one attack. But after that, the cat hated the woman. Just hated her. Would attack her anytime she came. He would, you know what cats do. Would hide underneath things and just nail her on the way by. And so they were thinking they were going to have to get rid of this cat because he was, you know, attacking the wife. And what I suggested and what eventually did work was changing every scent about that woman. We took off, she stopped using the same kind of shampoo that she'd been using. We had her use a different kind of cream. I had her wash all of her clothes in like, you know, 3 or 4 times. And so in every single thing we could think of, except of course her body odor, we couldn't change that, but we could change everything else about her to change the association that was linked to that traumatic learning experience on the part of the cat, and it worked. So sometimes, I mean, we forget, remember? In talking about the what dogs, you know, see differently from us and all that, think about what they smell. They can smell a drop of urine in a lake. They can smell whether you're pregnant. They can smell, you know, they can smell all kinds of stuff. So it is, you know, it would be useful, I think, to change the smell. And I think that liquid fence sounds great.
I think that's a great idea. I think the obedience is, but the problem is if it's like a thoroughfare for critters, like,
then
there's
you,
nothing you can do.
Depends on the kind of house and yard it is,
yeah.
But you can get I can't remember what it's called. I don't think it's called cat fencing, but it goes up, it attaches to your roof,
okay.
And goes over your fence. It's really light.
Okay.
Wire, you know, like chicken
yeah.
wire, except it's really light. It's
yeah.
it's almost sits, and
oh,
birds
so can.
Come in. It's like yeah, birds can come in, but that's it.
What is it called?
I don't know.
I did tell them to take like chicken wire and cover their fence. And
but you do it all the way over,
okay.
And it actually is wonderful for people who have cats who like to have their cats outside, mm-hmm. But because it stops predators from coming in and it stops the cat
yeah.
from leaving.
If you remember the name.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think, because I have a client who had like a half an acre, and she put this stuff over the entire half an acre. She had a lot of trees, because
wow.
It sits on the top of trees, and then it just stays there.
Is it made out of metal, or is it plastic?
It's made out of the thing that she had was made out of a plastic. It was kind
so
of
is
a...
Is it deer fencing?
It's like deer fencing, very much like it,
like
but
fur.
You couldn't see it. If you looked up, you couldn't see it. It was black, you know, and... We can't see.
Sure,
we can always
netting?
See through black. It's all. It's
yeah.
interesting to me.
Are you sure it wasn't bird netting?
I don't know.
Because
it's been a long time. I'm an old
excuse.
Lady.
No excuse.
Okay, but yeah, I would go for scent, and then I would probably try to make it so that the nothing could come in. So see the things the dogs learn, and we just don't know they're learning. Okay, so again, with any of these different kinds of learning, just really think about examples in your own life so that you can, because what you want to do is be able to get so familiar with it that you can go, okay, that looks like that was single event learning. In order to counteract this, we may have to do something fairly dramatic or whatever. Because with single event learning, because most of it resides in the amygdala, it's really hard to get rid of. Whereas with slow learning, you can almost, you know, what they say is what is learned can be unlearned. And that's true of certain kinds of learning, but not of all kinds of learning. You look cold back there. Are you freezing? Yeah, it's definitely cold in here. Okay, so habituation is, turn this off, not that you're actually going to be able to feel it from there, but hey. Habituation is when events of no significance occur repeatedly, and that induces habituation. A really good example of this is in the old book Black Beauty. I don't know if you ever read that, but they were training Black Beauty to be able to cope with life in civilized England. And so they put him in a pasture with a bunch of other horses that had what they call lorries, trucks going by all the time. And the first few times a truck went by, he'd freak. And by the 20th time, he realized that it had no effect on him. And it really helped because there was social facilitation, because there were other horses in the field as well. So the other horses were going, what's your problem? You know, because he spooked. And if you've ever seen a horse spook, you know, they spook. they run all over the place. So habituation is my very favorite form of behavior modification. If I can use habituation, I will use habituation because it's one of the most permanent. So, and that's kind of cool, right? Is that if you've taught a dog that this is the way life is, then they just start to accept it, and it's okay. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't have its drawbacks, but it is a really cool way to do behavior mod. So if a dog lives by a freeway, he'll get used to cars going by. At first, he might go, oh, every time a car goes by, right? But very quickly, he's going to learn that noise has no effect on him. Now, if you're really close to the freeway, it might take him about, you know, twice or three times longer than if you're farther away. So if you're doing habituation, you kind of use desensitization along with it, then you might move him closer in. But essentially, he's not having to do anything. He's just learning that life goes on. And I think that's almost what I use with behavior mod for separation anxiety. I hadn't really thought of it this way because I think of it as being desensitization, but I think it's more habituation, because what I usually suggest is they go in and out of the house many times in kind of fairly rapid succession without making any kind of comment whatsoever, and then stop and don't do anything and then do it again. And so it is not, you're not actually trying to get them. Most people who work with separation anxiety really try to do increments of, you know, 3 minutes and 5 minutes and 7 minutes and 9 minutes. And mine are like 3 minutes and 10 minutes and 2 minutes and 15 minutes. And, you know, so I'm not trying to do bigger and bigger increments as much as I'm trying to do high repetitions. And that repetition is what causes the dog's brain to kind of go, oh, well, this is no big deal. I'm just going to get used to this. This is okay. So you can see why this is a wonderful method of behavior mod, right? It's not a, it's no big deal. It's just no big deal. If you could take your person and just have a whole bunch of animals go by and it not mean anything, it'd be fine. But he'd be going into a frenzy.
Yeah. So what do you do with a delivery truck? When every time they go by, your dog barks, even though they go by every day, several times a day, especially like at Christmas.
Uh-huh.
How do you habituate your dog? Do you get a sound? And you do
well, this okay, so habituation is very difficult to do if you have sounds that are not predictable. So if you don't know when the vehicle is going to go by, and you can't do a lot of it, then you're probably going to be less likely, because you have low repetitions, and you have a lot of time. Remember what we talked about a long time ago, which is essentially that if you have a high, why can't I think of my words? Something is a high contrast. So if it's really quiet in your house, and then a truck goes by, and the noise, the decibel level goes up this much, and then it goes back down again, that's high contrast, and that's likely to cause an emotional spike. You know, that jolt of, right? And so if you can't habituate with that, what you would need to do is put him in a place where he's going to hear this kind of stuff from further away, and have him be busy doing something else, whatever it might be. But if you've got high contrast, that kind of thing, that environmental change, that causes more behavior problems in our dogs than almost anything else. On the other hand, in a shelter, they have no such thing as quiet. And so it's, or in some shelters, it's very quiet. In Monterey, it's too quiet. You know, there's a lot of shelters where it's too quiet nowadays, and the dogs get that high contrast too easily. Yes, absolutely. In fact, you could probably set that one up.
Yeah.
Right? You could have it, if the dog kind of freaks out by some people going by, you just kind of sit there and do nothing. Mm-hmm. And again, this is why habituation is so much fun. You can read a book, and you're just telling the dog, I'm not worried, you're not worried, we're not worried, nobody's worried.
Can you ask them to do something to redirect their
behavior? If you're doing that, then you're doing what's called a DRI, which is a differential reinforcement of an incompatible behavior, but which we will talk about later.
Okay.
And you probably wouldn't want to try to do. You'd probably want to try to do habituation first because it's much more permanent.
Okay.
If a dog has to, if you are telling a dog to do something else when something traumatic is happening, then you're actually comparing and contrasting. You're actually adding a different behavior. So then, in order to get the dog to accept it well, you have to reduce this other behavior,
right,
or eliminate it. So now you have another learning curve. And what we want is one learning curve if we can make it that way.
Right.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's extremely ingrained, like this dog's been doing this for, I don't know, years and years and years, I mean, sort of having that sitting down and doing nothing, are they going to be aware that that's what you're doing? Because we've got a dog downstairs in our apartment who I think has separation anxiety, yeah, from everything you've said, and barks at everything. Anything's out there, and she has tried putting blinds down, but they're only partial blinds, so I think it even sees movement, any noise, and
so she needs more management, because she needs to not, the blinds are not going to be enough. She probably needs some artscape or something to go over the windows. It looks like stained glass window, except for it just stick it up there, and you can take it off and down whenever you want to. But it's called artscape, and it's pretty. So, you know, people, I like to make it so that people like to do the things I want them to do, you know, or they don't object too hard to those things. So if this were my dog, what I would probably do is get either a radio or white noise, put it right next to the window.
Okay.
So that you take the contrast and you eliminate the contrast. So you're going to increase the ambient noise in the house. That will decrease the ambient noise outside to the dog's hearing. And it will drop the dog's tendency to be reactive. So we have to remember all this sudden environmental change is going on all the time that we completely, you know, we've habituated to it. We don't even notice it. But for an animal, particularly a fearful animal or an animal that comes from a place that's very rural or very, very urban and goes to a suburban life, that's hard. Suburban life is the hardest because suburban life is very quiet. Yeah, everything is quiet, and all of a sudden something happens, right? Whereas in an urban environment, it's noisy all the time. You're always getting the beep, beep, beeps of things backing up and all that kind of stuff. So the dogs get used to it, but they don't in suburban life. So on garbage day, I had one student who on garbage day, were you in that class? The dog is like, you know, just because. Because it's so different every garbage day. And the dog now really likes it because it's a chance to get excited. So he sits and waits for the garbage truck to go by.
So I just noticed that yesterday in Golden Gate Park, I said to my partner that I think city dogs are the most well-adjusted dogs. And our puppy was like, this is okay as long as other people don't come near us.
Mm-hmm.
But it was weird for her, even though she's been to parks, but not to Golden Gate Park.
Yeah.
And not to San Francisco, but all the other dogs, there were many off leash.
Yeah.
Luckily, they didn't run up to her. They were all very well trained. They were like, whatever, we don't care.
Oh, yeah, city dogs are the best. You know, that's when people get a new dog and they ask me to come and work with their new dog, and they're, you know, Ian Dunbar says, you know, have them go meet 100 people or do this 100 places and all that kind of stuff. And my advice is usually, where do you intend to live with this dog? If you intend to live with this dog in suburbia, he better get used to suburbia. If you're going to live in rural area, that's what he needs to get used to. You do not have to go to the city if you're never going to go to the city with the dog. But if you are, then a city is a great place to teach a dog that noises don't matter. That doesn't mean they're not going to still, if they go someplace really quiet, still startle at a really loud noise. And remember that whole thing about noises, that if you can't predict when the noise is going to happen, and you cannot orient to the place that the noise is coming from, it will cause anxiety in the dog. Those are the two things. They need to be able to orient to the noise, and so they need to know where it's coming from, and they also need to be able to, you know, it shouldn't come out of nowhere, where it does, you know. So those, that's what you're always looking for noise-sensitive dogs particularly. Like the person who had the dog that was afraid of the foghorn. She couldn't orient to it. It always startled her. And it was really hard. And the only thing that fixed it for her was the dryer. Remember that? Yeah. But the problem is then the woman had to get up every 2 hours to turn the dryer back on again. So somebody wasn't going to get any sleep. It could be her, or it could be the dog. Okay, so habituation can have spontaneous recovery. I have not seen this happen very often, but if the sound of the freeway changed, the reaction